As it turns out, things are not quite so simple. The result of applying these models to the data is revealing. The one-factor model, unsurprisingly, misses a lot of the exact data points, though it captures the basic trend, a comedown after the honeymoon bliss. However, its straight-line prediction forecasts that this decrease will continue forever, ultimately resulting in infinite misery. Something about that trajectory doesn't sound quite right. The two-factor model comes closer to fitting the survey data, and its curved shape makes a different long-term prediction, suggesting that after the initial decline, life satisfaction more or less levels out over time. Finally, the nine-factor model passes through each and every point on the chart. It is essentially a perfect fit for all the data from the study. In that sense, it seems like the nine-factor formula is indeed our best model. But if you look at the predictions it makes for the years not included in the study, you might wonder about just how useful it really is. It predicts misery at the altar, a giddily abrupt rise in satisfaction after several months of marriage, a bumpy roller coaster ride thereafter, and a sheer drop after year 10. By contrast, the leveling off predicted by the two-factor model is the forecast most consistent with what psychologists and economists say about marriage and happiness. They believe, incidentally, that it simply reflects a return to normalcy, to people's baseline level of satisfaction with their lives, rather than any displeasure with marriage itself. The lesson is this. It is indeed true that including more factors in a model will always, by definition, make it a better fit for the data we have already. But a better fit for the available data does not necessarily mean a better prediction. Granted, a model that's too simple, for instance, the straight line of the one-factor formula, can fail to capture the essential pattern in the data. If the truth looks like a curve, no straight line can ever get it right. On the other hand, a model that's too complicated, such as our nine-factor model here, becomes oversensitive to the particular data points that we happen to observe. As a consequence, precisely because it is tuned so finely to that specific data set, the solutions it produces are highly variable. If the study were repeated with different people, producing slight variations on the same essential pattern, the one and two-factor models would remain more or less steady, but the nine-factor model would gyrate wildly from one instance of the study to the next. This is what statisticians call overfitting. So one of the deepest truths of machine learning is that, in fact, it's not always better to use a more complex model, one that takes a greater number of factors into account. And the issue is not just that the extra factors might offer diminishing returns, performing better than a simpler model but not enough to justify the added complexity. Rather, they might make our predictions dramatically worse. The idolatry of data. If we had copious data drawn from a perfectly representative sample, completely mistake-free and representing exactly what we're trying to evaluate, then using the most complex model available would indeed be the best approach. But if we try to perfectly fit our model to the data when any of these factors fails to hold, we risk overfitting. In other words, overfitting poses a danger any time we're dealing with noise or mismeasurement, and we almost always are. There can be errors in how the data were collected or in how they were reported. Sometimes the phenomena being investigated, such as human happiness, are hard to even define, let alone measure. Thanks to their flexibility, the most complex models available to us can fit any patterns that appear in the data, but this means that they will also do so even when those patterns are mere phantoms and mirages in the noise. Throughout history, religious texts have warned their followers against idolatry, the worshipping of statues, paintings, relics, and other tangible artifacts in lieu of the intangible deities those artifacts represent. The first commandment, for instance, warns against bowing down to any graven image or any likeness of anything that is in heaven. And in the book of Kings, a bronze snake made at God's orders becomes an object of worship and incense burning instead of God himself. God is not amused. Fundamentally, overfitting is a kind of idolatry of data, a consequence of focusing on what we've been able to measure rather than what matters. This gap between the data we have and the predictions we want is virtually everywhere. When making a big decision, we can only guess at what will please us later by thinking about the factors important to us right now. As Harvard's Daniel Gilbert puts it, our future selves often pay good money to remove the tattoos that we paid good money to get. When making a financial forecast, we can only look at what correlated with the price of a stock in the past, not what might in the future. Even in our small daily acts, this pattern holds. Writing an email, we use our own read-through of the text to predict that of the recipient. No less than in public surveys, the data in our own lives are thus also always noisy, at best a proxy metric for the things we really care about. As a consequence, considering more and more factors and expending more effort to model them can lead us into the error of optimizing for the wrong thing, offering prayers to the bronze snake of data rather than the larger force behind it. Overfitting everywhere. Once you know about overfitting, you see it everywhere. Overfitting, for instance, explains the irony of our palates. How can it be that the foods that taste best to us are broadly considered to be bad for our health, when the entire function of the taste buds, evolutionarily speaking, is to prevent us from eating things that are bad? The answer is that taste is our body's proxy metric for health. Fat, sugar, and salt are important nutrients, and for a couple hundred thousand years, being drawn to foods containing them was a reasonable measure for a sustaining diet. But being able to modify the foods available to us broke that relationship. We can now add fat and sugar to foods beyond amounts that are good for us, and then eat those foods exclusively, rather than the mix of plants, grains, and meats that historically made up the human diet. In other words, we can overfit taste. And the more skillfully we can manipulate food, and the more our lifestyles diverge from those of our ancestors, the more imperfect a metric taste becomes. Our human agency thus turns into a curse, making us dangerously able to have exactly what we want, even when we don't quite want exactly the right thing. Beware, when you go to the gym to work off the extra weight from all that sugar, you can also risk overfitting fitness. Certain visible signs of fitness, low body fat and high muscle mass, for example, are easy to measure, and they are related to, say, minimizing the risk of heart disease and other ailments. But they too are an imperfect proxy measure. Overfitting the signals, adopting an extreme diet to lower body fat and taking steroids to build muscle, perhaps, can make you the picture of good health, but only the picture. Overfitting also shows up in sports. For instance, Tom has been a fencer, on and off, since he was a teenager. The original goal of fencing was to teach people how to defend themselves in a duel, hence the name, defencing. And the weapons used in modern fencing are similar to those that were used to train for such encounters. This is particularly true of the épée, which was still used in formal duels less than 50 years ago. But the introduction of electronic scoring equipment, a button on the tip of the blade that registers a hit, has changed the nature of the sport, and techniques that would serve you poorly in a serious duel have become critical skills in competition. Modern fencers use flexible blades that allow them to flick the button at their opponent, grazing just hard enough to register and score. As a result, they can look more like they're cracking thin metal whips at each other than cutting or thrusting. It's as exciting a sport as ever, But as athletes overfit their tactics to the quirks of scorekeeping, it becomes less useful in instilling the skills of real-world swordsmanship. Perhaps nowhere, however, is overfitting as powerful and troublesome as in the world of business. Incentive structures work, as Steve Jobs put it, so you have to be very careful of what you incent people to do, because various incentive structures create all sorts of consequences that you can't anticipate. Sam Altman, president of the startup incubator Y Combinator, echoes Jobs' words of caution. It really is true that the company will build whatever the CEO decides to measure. In fact, it's incredibly difficult to come up with incentives or measurements that do not have some kind of perverse effect. In the 1950s, Cornell management professor V.F. Ridgway cataloged a host of such dysfunctional consequences of performance measurements. At a job placement firm, staffers were evaluated on the number of interviews they conducted, which motivated them to run through the meetings as quickly as possible without spending much time actually helping their clients find jobs. At a federal law enforcement agency, investigators given monthly performance quotas were found to pick easy cases at the end of the month, rather than the most urgent ones. And at a factory, focusing on production metrics led supervisors to neglect maintenance and repairs, setting up future catastrophe. Such problems can't simply be dismissed as a failure to achieve management goals. Rather, they are the opposite, the ruthless and clever optimization of the wrong thing. The 21st century shift into real-time analytics has only made the danger of metrics more intense. Avinash Kaushik, digital marketing evangelist at Google, warns that trying to get website users to see as many ads as possible naturally devolves into trying to cram sites with ads. When you are paid on a cost per thousand impressions basis, the incentive is to figure out how to show the most possible ads on every page and ensure the visitor sees the most possible pages on the site. That incentive removes a focus from the important entity, your customer, and places it on the secondary entity, your advertiser. The website might gain a little more money in the short term, but ad-crammed articles, slow-loading multi-page slideshows, and sensationalist clickbait headlines will drive away readers in the long run. Kaushik's conclusion, friends don't let friends measure page views. Ever. In some cases, the difference between a model and the real world is literally a matter of life and death. In the military and in law enforcement, for example, repetitive rote training is considered a key means for instilling line-of-fire skills. The goal is to drill certain motions and tactics to the point that they become totally automatic. But when overfitting creeps in, it can prove disastrous. There are stories of police officers who find themselves, for instance, taking time out during a gunfight to put their spent casings in their pockets. Good etiquette on a firing range. As former Army Ranger and West Point psychology professor Dave Grossman writes, after the smoke had settled in many real gunfights, officers were shocked to discover empty brass in their pockets with no memory of how it got there. On several occasions, dead cops were found with brass in their hands, dying in the middle of an administrative procedure that had been drilled into them. Similarly, the FBI was forced to change its training after agents were found reflexively firing two shots and then holstering their weapon, a standard cadence in training, regardless of whether their shots had hit the target and whether there was still a threat. Mistakes like these are known in law enforcement and the military as training scars, and they reflect the fact that it's possible to overfit one's own preparation. In one particularly dramatic case, an officer instinctively grabbed the gun out of the hands of an assailant and then instinctively handed it right back, just as he had done time and again with his trainers in practice. Detecting overfitting, cross-validation. Because overfitting presents itself initially as a theory that perfectly fits the available data, it may seem insidiously hard to detect. How can we expect to tell the difference between a genuinely good model and one that's overfitting? In an educational setting, how can we distinguish between a class of students excelling at the subject matter and a class merely being taught to the test? In the business world, how can we tell a genuine star performer from an employee who has just cannily overfit their work to the company's key performance indicators, or to the boss's perception? Teasing apart those scenarios is indeed challenging, but it is not impossible. Research in machine learning has yielded several concrete strategies for detecting overfitting, and one of the most important is what's known as cross-validation. Simply put, cross-validation means assessing not only how well a model fits the data it's given, but how well it generalizes to data it hasn't seen. Paradoxically, this may involve using less data. In the marriage example, we might hold back, say, 2 points at random, and fit our models only to the other 8. We'd then take those 2 test points and use them to gauge how well our various functions generalize beyond the 8 training points they've been given. The 2 held back points function as canaries in the coal mine. If a complex model nails the 8 training points but wildly misses the 2 test points, it's a good bet that overfitting is at work. Aside from withholding some of the available data points, it is also useful to consider testing the model with the data derived from some other form of evaluation entirely. As we have seen, the use of proxy metrics, taste as a proxy for nutrition, number of cases solved as a proxy for investigator diligence, can also lead to overfitting. In these cases, we'll need to cross-validate the primary performance measure we're using against other possible measures. In schools, for example, standardized tests offer a number of benefits, including a distinct economy of scale. They can be graded cheaply and rapidly by the thousands. Alongside such tests, however, schools could randomly assess some small fraction of the students, 1 per class, say, or 1 in 100, using a different evaluation method, perhaps something like an essay or an oral exam. Since only a few students would be tested this way, having this secondary method scale well is not a big concern. The standardized tests would provide immediate feedback. You could have students take a short computerized exam every week and chart the class's progress almost in real time, for instance. While the secondary data points would serve to cross-validate, to make sure that the students were actually acquiring the knowledge that the standardized test is meant to measure, and not simply getting better at test-taking. If a school's standardized scores rose while its non-standardized performance moved in the opposite direction, administrators would have a clear warning sign that teaching to the test had set in, and the pupil's skills were beginning to overfit the mechanics of the test itself. Cross-validation also offers a suggestion for law enforcement and military personnel looking to instill good reflexes without hammering in habits from the training process itself. Just as essays and oral exams can cross-validate standardized tests, so occasional unfamiliar cross-training assessments might be used to measure whether reaction time and shooting accuracy are generalizing to unfamiliar tasks. If they aren't, then that's a strong signal to change the training regimen. While nothing may truly prepare one for actual combat, exercises like this may at least warn in advance where training scars are likely to have formed. How to combat overfitting, penalizing complexity. If you can't explain it simply, you don't understand it well enough. Anonymous. We've seen some of the ways that overfitting can rear its head, and we've looked at some of the methods to detect and measure it. But what can we actually do to alleviate it? From a statistics viewpoint, overfitting is a symptom of being too sensitive to the actual data we've seen. The solution, then, is straightforward. We must balance our desire to find a good fit against the complexity of the models we use to do so. One way to choose among several competing models is the Occam's razor principle, which suggests that, all things being equal, the simplest possible hypothesis is probably the correct one. Of course, things are rarely completely equal, so it's not immediately obvious how to apply something like Occam's razor in a mathematical context. Grappling with this challenge in the 1960s, Russian mathematician Andrei Tikhonov proposed one answer. Introduce an additional term to your calculations that penalizes more complex solutions. If we introduce a complexity penalty, then more complex models need to do not merely a better job, but a significantly better job of explaining the data to justify their greater complexity. Computer scientists refer to this principle, using constraints that penalize models for their complexity, as regularization. So what do these complexity penalties look like? One algorithm discovered in 1996 by biostatistician Robert Tibshirani is called the lasso and uses as its penalty the total weight of the different factors in the model. By putting this downward pressure on the weights of the factors, the lasso drives as many of them as possible completely to zero. Only the factors that have a big impact on the results remain in the equation, thus potentially transforming, say, an overfitted nine-factor model into a simpler, more robust formula with just a couple of the most critical factors. Techniques like the lasso are now ubiquitous in machine learning, but the same kind of principle, a penalty for complexity, also appears in nature. Living organisms get a certain push toward simplicity almost automatically, thanks to the constraints of time, memory, energy, and attention. The burden of metabolism, for instance, acts as a brake on the complexity of organisms, introducing a caloric penalty for overly elaborate machinery. The fact that the human brain burns about a fifth of humans' total daily caloric intake is a testament to the evolutionary advantages that our intellectual abilities provide us with. The brain's contributions must somehow more than pay for that sizable fuel bill. On the other hand, we can also infer that a substantially more complex brain probably didn't provide sufficient dividends, evolutionarily speaking. We're as brainy as we have needed to be, but not extravagantly more so. The same kind of process is also believed to play a role at the neural level. In computer science, software models based on the brain, known as artificial neural networks, can learn arbitrarily complex functions. They're even more flexible than the nine-factor model we previously discussed. But precisely because of this very flexibility, they are notoriously vulnerable to overfitting. Actual biological neural networks sidestep some of this problem because they need to trade off their performance against the costs of maintaining it. Neuroscientists have suggested, for instance, that brains try to minimize the number of neurons that are firing at any given moment, implementing the same kind of downward pressure on complexity as the lasso. Language forms yet another natural lasso. Complexity is punished by the labor of speaking at greater length and the taxing of our listeners' attention span. Business plans get compressed to an elevator pitch. Life advice becomes proverbial wisdom only if it's sufficiently concise and catchy. And anything that needs to be remembered has to pass through the inherent lasso of memory. The upside of heuristics. The economist Harry Markowitz won the 1990 Nobel Prize in Economics for developing modern portfolio theory. His groundbreaking mean variance portfolio optimization showed how an investor could make an optimal allocation among various funds and assets to maximize returns at a given level of risk. So when it came time to invest his own retirement savings, it seems like Markowitz should have been the one person perfectly equipped for the job. What did he decide to do? I should have computed the historical covariances of the asset classes and drawn an efficient frontier. Instead, I visualized my grief if the stock market went way up and I wasn't in it, or if it went way down and I was completely in it. My intention was to minimize my future regret. So I split my contributions 50-50 between bonds and equities. Why in the world would he do that? The story of the Nobel Prize winner and his investment strategy could be presented as an example of human irrationality. Faced with the complexity of real life, he abandoned the rational model and followed a simple heuristic. But it's precisely because of the complexity of real life that a simple heuristic might in fact be the rational solution. When it comes to portfolio management, it turns out that unless you're highly confident in the information you have about the markets, you may actually be better off ignoring that information altogether. Applying Markowitz's optimal portfolio allocation scheme requires having good estimates of the statistical properties of different investments. An error in those estimates can result in very different asset allocations, potentially increasing risk. In contrast, splitting your money evenly across stocks and bonds is not affected at all by what data you've observed. This strategy doesn't even try to fit itself to historical performance of those investment types, so there's no way it can overfit. Of course, just using a 50-50 split is not necessarily the complexity sweet spot, but there's something to be said for it. If you happen to know the expected mean and expected variance of a set of investments, then use mean variance portfolio optimization. The optimal algorithm is optimal for a reason. But when the odds of estimating them all correctly are low, and the weight that the model puts on those untrustworthy quantities is high, then an alarm should be going off in the decision-making process. It's time to regularize. Inspired by examples like Markowitz's retirement savings, psychologists Gerd Gigerenzer and Harry Brighton have argued that the decision-making shortcuts people use in the real world are, in many cases, exactly the kind of thinking that makes for good decisions. In contrast to the widely held view that less processing reduces accuracy, they write, the study of heuristics shows that less information, computation, and time can, in fact, improve accuracy. A heuristic that favors simpler answers, with fewer factors or less computation, offers precisely these less is more effects. Imposing penalties on the ultimate complexity of a model is not the only way to alleviate overfitting, however. You can also nudge a model towards simplicity by controlling the speed with which you allow it to adapt to incoming data. This makes the study of overfitting an illuminating guide to our history, both as a society and as a species. The weight of history. Every food a living rat has eaten has necessarily not killed it. Samuel Rivusky and Erwin Bedarf, Association of Illness with Prior Ingestion of Novel Foods. The soy milk market in the United States more than quadrupled from the mid-1990s to 2013. But by the end of 2013, according to news headlines, it already seemed to be a thing of the past, a distant second place to almond milk. As food and beverage researcher Larry Finkel told Bloomberg Businessweek, nuts are trendy now. Soy sounds more like old-fashioned health food. The Silk Company, famous for popularizing soy milk, as the name implies, reported in late 2013 that its almond milk products had grown by more than 50% in the previous quarter alone. Meanwhile, in other beverage news, the leading coconut water brand, Vita Coco, reported in 2014 that its sales had doubled since 2011 and had increased an astounding 300-fold since 2004. As the New York Times put it, coconut water seems to have jumped from invisible to unavoidable without a pause in the realm of the vaguely familiar. Meanwhile, the kale market grew by 40% in 2013 alone. The biggest purchaser of kale the year before had been Pizza Hut, which put it in their salad bars as decoration. Some of the most fundamental domains of human life, such as the question of what we should put in our bodies, seem curiously to be the ones most dominated by short-lived fads. Part of what enables these fads to take the world by storm is how quickly our culture can change. Information now flows through society faster than ever before, while global supply chains enable consumers to rapidly change their buying habits en masse, and marketing encourages them to do so. If some particular study happens to suggest a health benefit from, say, star anise, it can be all over the blogosphere within the week, on television the week after that, and in seemingly every supermarket in 6 months, with dedicated star anise cookbooks soon rolling off the presses. This breathtaking speed is both a blessing and a curse. In contrast, if we look at the way organisms, including humans, evolve, we notice something intriguing. Change happens slowly. This means that the properties of modern-day organisms are shaped not only by their present environments, but also by their history. For example, the oddly cross-wired arrangement of our nervous system, the left side of our body controlled by the right side of our brain and vice versa, reflects the evolutionary history of vertebrates. This phenomenon, called decussation, is theorized to have arisen at a point in evolution when early vertebrates' bodies twisted 180 degrees with respect to their heads, whereas the nerve cords of invertebrates such as lobsters and earthworms run on the belly side of the animal, vertebrates have their nerve cords along the spine instead. The human ear offers another example. Viewed from a functional perspective, it is a system for translating sound waves into electrical signals by way of amplification via three bones, the malleus, incus, and stapes. This amplification system is impressive, but the specifics of how it works have a lot to do with historical constraints. Reptiles, it turns out, have just a single bone in their ear, but additional bones in the jaw that mammals lack. Those jaw bones were apparently repurposed in the mammalian ear. So the exact form and configuration of our ear anatomy reflects our evolutionary history, at least as much as it does the auditory problem being solved. The concept of overfitting gives us a way of seeing the virtue in such evolutionary baggage. Though crossed-over nerve fibers and repurposed jawbones may seem like suboptimal arrangements, we don't necessarily want evolution to fully optimize an organism to every shift in its environmental niche. Or at least, we should recognize that doing so would make it extremely sensitive to further environmental changes. Having to make use of existing materials, on the other hand, imposes a kind of useful restraint. It makes it harder to induce drastic changes in the structure of organisms, harder to overfit. As a species, being constrained by the past makes us less perfectly adjusted to the present we know, but helps keep us robust for the future we don't. A similar insight might help us resist the quick-moving fads of human society. When it comes to culture, tradition plays the role of the evolutionary constraints. A bit of conservatism, a certain bias in favor of history, can buffer us against the boom-and-bust cycle of fads. That doesn't mean we ought to ignore the latest data either, of course. Jump towards the bandwagon, by all means, but not necessarily on it. In machine learning, the advantages of moving slowly emerge most concretely in a regularization technique known as early stopping. When we looked at the German marriage survey data at the beginning of the chapter, we went straight to examining the best-fitted 1, 2, and 9-factor models. In many situations, however, tuning the parameters to find the best possible fit for given data is a process in and of itself. What happens if we stop that process early and simply don't allow a model the time to become too complex? Again, what might seem at first blush like being half-hearted or unthorough emerges instead as an important strategy in its own right. Many prediction algorithms, for instance, start out by searching for the single most important factor rather than jumping to a multi-factor model. Only after finding that first factor do they look for the next most important factor to add to the model, then the next, and so on. Their models can therefore be kept from becoming overly complex simply by stopping the process short before overfitting has had a chance to creep in. A related approach to calculating predictions considers one data point at a time, with the model tweaked to account for each new point before more points are added. There, too, the complexity of the model increases gradually, so stopping the process short can help keep it from overfitting. This kind of setup, where more time means more complexity, characterizes a lot of human endeavors. Giving yourself more time to decide about something does not necessarily mean you'll make a better decision. But it does guarantee that you'll end up considering more factors, more hypotheticals, more pros and cons, and thus risk overfitting. Tom had exactly this experience when he first became a professor. His first semester, teaching his first class ever, he spent a huge amount of time perfecting his lectures, more than 10 hours of preparation for every hour of class. His second semester, teaching a different class, he wasn't able to put in as much time and worried that it would be a disaster. But a strange thing happened. The students liked the second class. In fact, they liked it more than the first one. Those extra hours, it turned out, had been spent nailing down nitty-gritty details that only confused the students, and wound up getting cut from lectures the next time Tom taught the class. The underlying issue, Tom eventually realized, was that he'd been using his own taste and judgment as a kind of proxy metric for his students. This proxy metric worked reasonably well as an approximation, but it wasn't worth overfitting, which explained why spending extra hours painstakingly perfecting all the slides had been counterproductive. The effectiveness of regularization in all kinds of machine learning tasks suggests that we can make better decisions by deliberately thinking and doing less. If the factors we come up with first are likely to be the most important ones, then beyond a certain point, thinking more about a problem is not only going to be a waste of time and effort, it will lead us to worse solutions. Early stopping provides the foundation for a reasoned argument against reasoning, the thinking person's case against thought. But turning this into practical advice requires answering one more question. When should we stop thinking? When to think less. As with all issues involving overfitting, how early to stop depends on the gap between what you can measure and what really matters. If you have all the facts, they're free of all error and uncertainty, and you can directly assess whatever is important to you, then don't stop early. Think long and hard. The complexity and effort are appropriate. But that's almost never the case. If you have high uncertainty and limited data, then do stop early, by all means. If you don't have a clear read on how your work will be evaluated and by whom, then it's not worth the extra time to make it perfect with respect to your own or anyone else's idiosyncratic guess at what perfection might be. The greater the uncertainty, the bigger the gap between what you can measure and what matters, the more you should watch out for overfitting. That is, the more you should prefer simplicity, and the earlier you should stop. When you're truly in the dark, the best laid plans will be the simplest. When our expectations are uncertain and the data are noisy, the best bet is to paint with a broad brush, to think in broad strokes. Sometimes, literally. As entrepreneurs Jason Fried and David Heinemeier Hansen explain, the further ahead they need to brainstorm, the thicker the pen they use. A clever form of simplification by stroke size. When we start designing something, We sketch out ideas with a big, thick Sharpie marker instead of a ballpoint pen. Why? Pen points are too fine. They're too high resolution. They encourage you to worry about things that you shouldn't worry about yet, like perfecting the shading or whether to use a dotted or dashed line. You end up focusing on things that should still be out of focus. A Sharpie makes it impossible to drill down that deep. You can only draw shapes, lines, and boxes. That's good. The big picture is all you should be worrying about in the beginning. As McGill University's Henry Mintzberg puts it, what would happen if we started from the premise that we can't measure what matters and go from there? Then, instead of measurement, we'd have to use something very scary. It's called judgment. The upshot of early stopping is that sometimes it's not a matter of choosing between being rational and going with our first instinct. Going with our first instinct can be the rational solution. The more complex, unstable, and uncertain the decision, the more rational approach that is. To return to Darwin, his problem of deciding whether to propose could probably have been resolved based on just the first few pros and cons he identified. With the subsequent ones adding to the time and anxiety expended on the decision, without necessarily aiding its resolution, and in all likelihood, impeding it. What seemed to make up his mind was the thought that it is intolerable to think of spending one's whole life like a neuter bee, working, working, and nothing after all. Children and companionship, the very first points he mentioned, were precisely those that ultimately swayed him in favor of marriage. His book budget was a distraction. Before we get too critical of Darwin, however, painting him as an inveterate overthinker, it's worth noting that Darwin was no Franklin, adding assorted considerations for days. Despite the seriousness with which he approached this life-changing choice, Darwin made up his mind exactly when his notes reached the bottom of the diary sheet. He was regularizing to the page. This is reminiscent of both early stopping and the lasso. Anything that doesn't make the page doesn't make the decision. His mind made up to marry, Darwin immediately went on to overthink the timing. When, soon or late, he wrote above another list of pros and cons. Considering everything from happiness to expenses to awkwardness to his long-standing desire to travel in a hot air balloon and or to Wales. But by the end of the page, he resolved to never mind, trust to chance, and the result, within several months' time, was a proposal to Emma Wedgwood, the start of a fulfilling partnership and a happy family life. 8. Relaxation. Let it slide. In 2010, Megan Bellows was working on her PhD in chemical engineering at Princeton by day and planning her wedding by night. Her research revolved around finding the right places to put amino acids in a protein chain to yield a molecule with particular characteristics. If you maximize the binding energy of two proteins, then you can successfully design a peptidic inhibitor of some biological function, so you can actually inhibit a disease's progress. On the nuptial front, she was stuck on the problem of seeding. There was a group of 9 college friends, and Bellows agonized over who else to throw into the midst of such a mini-reunion to make a table of 10. Even worse, she'd counted up 11 close relatives. Who would get the boot from the honored parents' table? And how could she explain it to them? And what about folks like her childhood neighbors and babysitter, or her parents' work colleagues, who didn't really know anyone at the wedding at all? The problem seemed every bit as hard as the protein problem she was working on at the lab. Then it hit her. It was the problem she was working on at the lab. One evening as she stared at her seating charts, I realized that there was literally a one-to-one correlation between the amino acids and proteins in my PhD thesis, and people sitting at tables at my wedding. Bellows called out to her fiancé for a piece of paper and began scribbling equations. Amino acids became guests, binding energies became relationships, and the molecules' so-called nearest neighbor interactions became, well, nearest neighbor interactions. She could use the algorithms from her research to solve her own wedding. Bellows worked out a way to numerically define the strength of the relationships between all the guests. If a particular pair of people didn't know one another, they got a 0. If they did, they got a 1. And if they were a couple, they got a 50. The sister of the bride got to give a score of 10 to all the people she wanted to sit with, as a special prerogative. Bellows then specified a few constraints. The maximum table capacity and a minimum score necessary for each table, so that no one table became the awkward miscellaneous group full of strangers. She also codified the program's goal, to maximize the relationship scores between the guests and their table mates. There were 107 people at the wedding, and 11 tables, which could accommodate 10 people each. This means there were about 11 to the 107th power possible seating plans. That's a 112-digit number, more than 200 billion Googles, a figure that dwarfs the merely 80-digit number of atoms in the observable universe. Bellows submitted the job to her lab computer on Saturday evening and let it churn. When she came in on Monday morning, it was still running. She had it spit out the best assignment it had found so far and put it back onto protein design. Even with a high-powered lab computer cluster and a full 36 hours of processing time, there was no way for the program to evaluate more than a tiny fraction of the potential seating arrangements. The odds are that the truly optimal solution, the one that would have earned the very highest score, never came up in its permutations. Still, Bellows was pleased with the computer's results. It identified relationships that we were forgetting about, she says, offering delightful, unconventional possibilities that the human planners hadn't even considered. For instance, it proposed removing her parents from the family table, putting them instead with old friends they hadn't seen for years. Its final recommendation was an arrangement that all parties agreed was a hit, although the mother of the bride couldn't resist making just a few manual tweaks. The fact that all the computing power of a lab at Princeton couldn't find the perfect seating plan might seem surprising. In most of the domains we've discussed so far, straightforward algorithms could guarantee optimal solutions. But as computer scientists have discovered over the past few decades, there are entire classes of problems where a perfect solution is essentially unreachable, no matter how fast we make our computers or how cleverly we program them. In fact, no one understands as well as a computer scientist that in the face of a seemingly unmanageable challenge, you should neither toil forever nor give up, but as we'll see, try a third thing entirely. The difficulty of optimization. Before leading the country through the American Civil War, before drafting the Emancipation Proclamation or delivering the Gettysburg Address, Abraham Lincoln worked as a prairie lawyer in Springfield, Illinois, traveling the 8th Judicial Circuit twice a year for 16 years. Being a circuit lawyer meant literally making a circuit, moving through towns in 14 different counties to try cases, riding hundreds of miles over many weeks. Planning these circuits raised a natural challenge: how to visit all the necessary towns while covering as few miles as possible and without going to any town twice. This is an instance of what's known to mathematicians and computer scientists as a constrained optimization problem. How to find the single best arrangement of a set of variables, given particular rules and a scorekeeping measure. In fact, it's the most famous optimization problem of them all. If it had been studied in the 19th century, it might have become forever known as the prairie lawyer problem, and if it had first come up in the 21st century, it might have been nicknamed the delivery drone problem. But like the secretary problem, it emerged in the mid-20th century, a period unmistakably evoked by its canonical name, the traveling salesman problem. The problem of route planning didn't get the attention of the mathematical community until the 1930s, but then it did so with a vengeance. Mathematician Carl Menger spoke of the postal messenger problem in 1930, noting that no easier solution was known than simply trying out every possibility in turn. Hassler Whitney posed the problem in a 1934 talk at Princeton, where it lodged firmly in the brain of fellow mathematician Merrill Flood, who you might recall from Chapter 1 is also credited with circulating the first solution to the secretary problem. When Flood moved to California in the 1940s, he spread it in turn to his colleagues at the Rand Institute, and the problem's iconic name first appeared in print in a 1949 paper by mathematician Julia Robinson. As the problem swept through mathematical circles, it grew in notoriety. Many of the greatest minds of the time obsessed over it, and no one seemed able to make real headway. In the traveling salesman problem, the question isn't whether a computer or a mathematician could find the shortest route. Theoretically, one can simply crank out a list of all the possibilities and measure each one. Rather, the issue is that as the number of towns grows, the list of possible routes connecting them explodes. A route is just an ordering of the towns, so trying them all by brute force is the dreaded big O of n factorial time, the computational equivalent of sorting a deck of cards by throwing them in the air until they happen to land in order. The question is there any hope of doing better? Decades of work did little to tame the traveling salesman problem. Flood, for instance, wrote in 1956, more than 20 years after first encountering it, "It seems very likely that quite a different approach from any yet used may be required for successful treatment of the problem. In fact, there may well be no general method for treating the problem, and impossibility results would also be valuable." Another decade later, the mood was only more grim. "I conjecture," wrote Jack Edmonds, "that there is no good algorithm for the traveling salesman problem." These words would prove prophetic. Defining difficulty. In the mid-1960s, Edmonds at the National Institute of Standards and Technology, along with Alan Cobham of IBM, developed a working definition for what makes a problem feasible to solve or not. They asserted what's now known as the Cobham-Edmonds thesis. An algorithm should be considered efficient if it runs in what's called polynomial time, that is, big O of n squared, big O of n cubed, or in fact, n to the power of any number at all. A problem, in turn, is considered tractable if we know how to solve it using an efficient algorithm. A problem we don't know how to solve in polynomial time, on the other hand, is considered intractable. And at anything but the smallest scales, intractable problems are beyond the reach of solution by computers, no matter how powerful. This amounts to what is arguably the central insight of computer science. It's possible to quantify the difficulty of a problem. And some problems are just hard. Where does this leave the traveling salesman problem? Curiously enough, we are still not quite sure. In 1972, Berkeley's Richard Karp demonstrated that the traveling salesman problem is linked to a controversially borderline class of problems that have not yet definitively been proven to be either efficiently solvable or not. But so far, there have been no efficient solutions found for any of those problems, making them effectively intractable. And most computer scientists believe that there aren't any to be found. So the impossibility result for the traveling salesman problem that Flood imagined in the 1950s is likely to be its ultimate fate. What's more, many other optimization problems, with implications for everything from political strategy to public health to fire safety, are similarly intractable. But for the computer scientists who wrestle with such problems, this verdict isn't the end of the story. Instead, it's more like a call to arms. Having determined a problem to be intractable, you can't just throw up your hands. As scheduling expert Jan Carl Lenstra told us, when the problem is hard, it doesn't mean that you can forget about it. It means that it's just in a different status. It's a serious enemy, but you still have to fight it. And this is where the field figured out something invaluable, something we can all learn from. How to best approach problems whose optimal answers are out of reach. How to relax. Just relax. The perfect is the enemy of the good. Voltaire. When somebody tells you to relax, it's probably because you're uptight, making a bigger deal out of things than you should. When computer scientists are up against a formidable challenge, their minds also turn to relaxation as they pass around books like An Introduction to Relaxation Methods or Discrete Relaxation Techniques. But they don't relax themselves. They relax the problem. One of the simplest forms of relaxation in computer science is known as constraint relaxation. In this technique, researchers remove some of the problem's constraints and set about solving the problem they wish they had. Then, after they've made a certain amount of headway, they try to add the constraints back in. That is, they make the problem temporarily easier to handle before bringing it back to reality. For instance, you can relax the traveling salesman problem by letting the salesman visit the same town more than once and letting him retrace his steps for free. Finding the shortest route under these looser rules produces what's called the minimum spanning tree. If you prefer, you can also think of the minimum spanning tree as the fewest miles of road needed to connect every town to at least one other town. As it turns out, solving this looser problem takes a computer essentially no time at all. And while the minimum spanning tree doesn't necessarily lead straight to the solution of the real problem, it is quite useful all the same. For one thing, the spanning tree, with its free backtracking, will never be any longer than the real solution, which has to follow all the rules. Therefore, we can use the relaxed problem, the fantasy, as a lower bound on the reality. If we calculate that the spanning tree distance for a particular set of towns is 100 miles, we can be sure the traveling salesman distance will be no less than that. And if we find, say, a 110-mile route, we can be certain it is at most 10% longer than the best solution. Thus, we can get a grasp of how close we are to the real answer, even without knowing what it is. Even better, in the traveling salesman problem, it turns out that the minimum spanning tree is actually one of the best starting points from which to begin a search for the real solution. Approaches like these have allowed even one of the largest traveling salesman problems imaginable, finding the shortest route that visits every single town on Earth, to be solved to within less than 0.05% of the unknown optimal solution. Though most of us haven't encountered the formal algorithmic version of constraint relaxation, its basic message is familiar to almost anyone who's dreamed big about life questions. What would you do if you weren't afraid? Reads a mantra you might have seen in a guidance counselor's office or heard at a motivational seminar. What would you do if you could not fail? Similarly, when considering questions of profession or career,